Now, Bon Anné, this is the message released by the Shri Aurobindo Ashram today to augure in the year 2017. It is the divine presence that gives value to life. This presence is the source of all peace, all joy, all security. Find this presence in yourself, and all your difficulties will disappear. The Mother. And welcome back to our continuing study of the Life Divine. We're now in the second book of the Life Divine, the 14th chapter. We just began it in our last session. The chapter is entitled The Origin and Remedy of Falsehood, Error, Wrong, and Evil. It seems apposite to the times. So in our last session, we saw that Sri Aurobindo, again, regards a single reality as a source of all being. There is only a conscious existent whose nature is delight, Satchit Ananda. Satchit Ananda is. It is fully aware of itself. Its experience of itself is illimitable bliss. But if this aspect of its being, which we call consciousness force, chit shakti, central to the being, decides to limit itself in terms of a knowledge. And if this knowledge, which is vast, multitudinous, and yet one, decides to further restrict itself, it can become, through self-limitation, a kind of ignorance where the divine ignores a part of its being in order to attend to a particular work that it wishes to function in. This does not exist above in the higher realms where there is only unwalled being. But if this wishes to manifest itself as a cosmos, as a universe, then this possibility comes in. We can look at this being as being an absolute, beyond all definition of determination in terms of time, space, form. We can see it as universality. We can see this being also as what we are personally, and all three are cognate with each other. Both universe and person arrive from that transcendent, from that absolute. So carry that innate bliss, that absolute consciousness, and that unalterable reality behind. We all have that. It is our secret that we must rediscover. But if this formation of ignorance comes into being, then we look for the origin of falsehood and evil, not in the absolute, but in this movement of self-limitation. Falsehood and ignorance, which are extremes of the perversity that ignorance can pursue, do not arise in that absolute. Our mental knowledge, going farther, what we have, which we call knowledge, is surrounded always by shades of ignorance because we are separated from. There, all is oneness. Here, we begin from division and try to reconstitute oneness. And so we're always looking for it, not finding it. So the knowledge that we have at the level of the mind is not truth. But despite the level of that mental ignorance, we can directly know through identity. So there is something innate in the consciousness even of mind that permits us to penetrate the veil of division and arrive back at a grand reunification with what we perceive to be the other, with what we perceive to be a distant absolute. So, as with knowledge, where we can use our limited truth to arrive at a greater truth, with good, we can use what is core to its true consciousness to overcome the apparent evil which arises from wrong consciousness, from limited consciousness. So in both cases, you see, he's arguing that while truth and good come stemming out of the absolute above, both error and evil and the things that are constituent of them come from that original limitation, from that ignorance which stands between that and this. So once consciousness force, chit shakti, manifests, opposites become cosmic possibilities. They can come into being. If we revert, if something in our consciousness wants to go back to the true source of things, then truth becomes sovereign and we reestablish ourselves in oneness and harmony. And that is the grand solution. So it's good to know that there's a route out of the problems of evil, theodicy. But where do they come from? Where do these opposites arise from? What is their point of location? This is what Sri Aurobindo begins to argue now. And let's begin with the last sentence of that last paragraph that we were looking at. He says, "Or if that is untenable, it may be that they arose," and here he's talking about where these opposites come in the cosmic manifestation. "It may be that they arose as an enabling supraphysical affirmation in the universal mind and life, a precedent necessity for their appearance in that manifestation, to which they more naturally belong as an inevitable outcome of the creative in conscience." So, what he's just said is that the tendency to error, the tendency to falsehood, the tendency to evil arises in planes above the physical. Supraphysical means literally above the physical. Now, they don't mean in terms of space above. It's not, 5 feet above our heads. No, it's an inner dimension. So the way that Vedantic thought has structured this in their cosmology is that seemingly at the base of things is matter, anna. Above matter is the power of life, prana. Above life is the power of manas, mind. There is a greater consciousness, a vast world above mind called mahas, also called vijnana, the great knowledge. And then linking, going above the gates to those splendorous worlds of bliss and true, pure consciousness and absolute being. Sat-chit ananda, vijnana, manas, prana, anam. So when he says supraphysical, if matter, anam, is the base, he means potentially all those planes above. But here, really, he's restricting himself to this layer cake of being, to the two, to prana, the world of life, above matter, and to mind above life. So here is the provisional error that permits all the darkness to arrive. But for some cosmic necessity, not for no reason, there is a reason. And this, of course, we're pursuing through the pages of this 1,100-page tome to get to his final answers to that riddle. So now we can begin, I think, tonight's work. It was for a long time held by the human mind as a traditional knowledge that when we go beyond the material plane, these things are found to exist there also in worlds beyond us. There are, in these planes of supraphysical experience, powers and forms of vital mind and life that seem to be the pre-physical foundation of the discordant, defective, or perverse forms and powers of life mind and life force which we find in the terrestrial existence. There are forces, and subliminal experience seems to show that there are supraphysical beings embodying those forces that are attached in their root nature to ignorance, to darkness of consciousness, to misuse of force, to perversity of delight, to all the causes and consequences of the things that we call evil. A clear reference to the Asuras, the Rakshasas, the Pishachas, well known to Indian mythology. These powers, beings or forces, are active to impose their adverse constructions upon terrestrial creatures, eager to maintain their reign in the manifestation. They oppose the increase of light and truth and good, and still more, are antagonistic to the progress of the soul towards a divine consciousness and divine existence. It is this feature of existence that we see figured in the tradition of the conflict between the powers of light and darkness, good and evil, cosmic harmony and cosmic anarchy, a tradition universal in ancient myth and in religion, and common to all systems of occult knowledge. The theory of this traditional knowledge is perfectly rational and verifiable by inner experience, and it imposes itself if we admit the supraphysical and do not cabin ourselves in the acceptation of material being as the only reality. In other words, if in our experience we can rise above our mere physicality and have sessions of contact and commerce with those planes and beings above, then we can know that they are real and not rely simply on sensation and all that is built upon sensation to be the only leaders of our life. We can let our consciousness, as we explore inner worlds, determine whether they are real or whether they are not real. As there is a cosmic self and spirit pervading and upholding the universe and its beings, so too there is a cosmic force that moves all things. And on this original cosmic force depend and act many cosmic forces that are its powers or arise as forms of its universal action. So there is a great being, a cosmic self, representing the person behind advancing, manifesting that transcendent absolute we've referred to. That cosmic self uses his great power, his force, to manifest many forces. And these many forces, in a sense, express the central force. So you can see that there is a cascading of personhood, of being and becoming, of dependence of one plane and power of action upon another above it, upon another above that. Whatever, he writes, is formulated in the universe has a force or forces that support it. Seek to fulfill or further it. Find their foundation in its functioning, their account of success in its success and growth and domination, their self-fulfillment, or their prolongation of being in its victory or survival. As there are powers of knowledge or forces of the light, so there are powers of ignorance and tenebrous forces of the darkness, whose work is to prolong the reign of ignorance and inconscience. As there are forces of truth, so there are forces that live by the falsehood and support it and work for its victory. As there are powers whose life is intimately bound up with the existence, the idea, and the impulse of good, so there are forces whose life is bound up with the existence and the idea and the impulse of the evil. It is this truth of the cosmic invisible that was symbolized in the ancient belief of a struggle between the powers of light and darkness, good and evil, for the possession of the world and the government of the life of man. This was the significance of the contest between the Vedic gods and their opponents, sons of darkness and division, figured in a later tradition as Titan and giant and demon, Asura, Rakshasa, Pishacha. The same tradition is found in the Zoroastrian double principle and the later Semitic opposition of God and his angels on the one side and Satan and his hosts on the other, invisible personalities and powers that draw man to the divine light and truth and good, or lure him into subjection to the undivine principle of darkness and falsehood and evil. Modern thought is aware of no invisible forces other than those revealed or constructed by science. It does not believe that nature is capable of creating any other beings than those around us in the physical world, men, beasts, birds, reptiles, fishes, insects, germs, and animalculae. But if there are invisible cosmic forces, physical in their nature, that act upon the body of inanimate objects, there is no valid reason why there should not be invisible cosmic forces, mental and vital, in their nature, that act upon his mind and his life force. And if mind and life, impersonal forces, form conscious beings or use persons to embody them in physical forms and in a physical world and can act upon matter and through matter, it is not impossible that on their own planes they should form conscious beings whose subtler substance is invisible to us, or that they should be able to act from those planes on beings in physical nature. Whatever reality or mythical unreality we may attach to the traditional figures of past human belief or experience, they would then be representations of things that are true in principle. In that case, the first source of good and evil would be not in terrestrial life or in the evolution from the inconscience, but in life itself. Their source would be supraphysical, and they would be reflected here from a larger supraphysical nature. So the idea, again, that there are invisible physical forces, gravity, for instance, we can't reach out and touch it, but we can see how it governs and dictates the process of things, molds, shifts, and if we can have a thought and then execute our thought, well, there's something that began on a psychological level and then became material by force of will, because the mind directed material agencies to act in this way. So it might be, and we can verify in our own experience, that there are forces, conscious, benign, malevolent, whatever they may be above, that could lean their influence into an active human agent and accomplish something through that. Why would that be impossible? We cannot measure it with a physical ruler. Is that the only measuring rod available in the universe, the only available to mind, to rationality? Is there not a greater principle of knowledge which we can explore? So the present occurrence of good and evil as we experience in this world may eventuate from sources within us and above us, from supraphysical sources. Here, he clearly demarcates the world of vitality, of prana, as the point of incidence for the departure from good into evil. And he continues, "This is certain, that when we go back into ourselves very deep away from the surface appearance, we find that the mind, heart, and sensational being of man are moved by forces not under his own control, and that he can become an instrument in the hands of energies of a cosmic character without knowing the origin of his actions. So we are used by cosmic forces unseen by us. It is by stepping back from the physical surface into his inner being and subliminal consciousness that he becomes directly aware of them and is able to know directly and deal with their action upon him. He grows aware of interventions which seek to lead him in one direction or another, of suggestions and impulsions which had disguised themselves as original movements of his own mind and against which he had to battle. He can realize that he is not a conscious creature inexplicably produced in an unconscious world out of a seed of an inconscient matter and moving about in an obscure self-ignorance, but an embodied soul through whose action cosmic nature is seeking to fulfill itself, the living ground of a vast debate between a darkness of ignorance out of which it emerges here and a light of knowledge which is growing upwards towards an unforeseen culmination." And if you'll forgive me for a little aside, this is so remindful of a passage that he wrote in Savitri that I want to read it to you. "The gods of light and titans of the dark battled for his soul as for a costly prize." So the whole of the cosmos is interested in what we, the puny human, is doing, because our soul is here to embody truths. And the wager, dark against light, is that I can get him to do this, I can get him to do that. And it is the emergence of our conscious true self that really dictates what happens in the universe. And the gods and the demons become important but background players when we rise to fulfillment. "The forces," he writes, "which seek to move him, and among them the forces of good and evil, present themselves as powers of universal nature, but they seem to belong not only to the physical universe, but to planes of life and mind beyond it. The first thing we have to know of importance to the problem preoccupying us is that these forces in their action seem often to surpass the measures of human relativity. They are, in their larger action, superhuman, divine, titanic, or demoniac. But they may create their formations in him, in large or in little, in his greatness or his smallness. They may seize and drive him at moments or for periods. They may influence his impulses or his acts or possess his whole nature. If that possession happens, he may himself be pushed to an excess of the normal humanity of good or evil. Especially the evil takes forms which shock the sense of human measure, exceed the bounds of human personality, approach the gigantic, the inordinate, the immeasurable. It may then be questioned whether it is not a mistake to deny absoluteness to evil. For as there is a drive, an aspiration, a yearning in man towards an absolute truth, good, beauty, so these movements, as also the transcending intensities attainable by pain and suffering, seem to indicate the attempt at self-realization of an absolute evil. But the immeasurable is not a sign of absoluteness. For the absolute is not in itself a thing of magnitude. It is beyond measure, not in the sole sense of vastness, but in the freedom of its essential being. It can manifest itself in the infinite. It can manifest itself in the infinitesimal as well as in the infinite. It is true that as we pass from the mental to the spiritual, and that is a passage towards the absolute, a subtle wideness and an increasing intensity of light, of power, of peace, of ecstasy, mark our passing out of our limitations. But this is at first only a sign of freedom, of height, of universality, not yet of an inward absoluteness of self-existence, which is the essence of the matter. To this absoluteness, pain and evil cannot attain. They are bound to limitation, and they are derivative. If pain becomes immeasurable, it ends itself or ends that in which it manifests, or collapses into insensibility, or in rare circumstances it may turn into an ecstasy of ananda. If evil became soul and immeasurable, it would destroy the world or destroy that which bore and supported it. It would bring things and itself back by disintegration into non-existence. No doubt the powers that support darkness and evil attempt, by the magnitude of their self-aggrandizement, to reach an appearance of infinity. But immensity is all they can achieve, and not infinity. Or at most, they are able to represent their element as a kind of abysmal infinite commensurate with the inconscient. But it is a false infinite. Self-existence, in essence or by an eternal inherence in the self-existent, is the condition of absoluteness. Error, falsehood, evil are cosmic powers, but relative in their nature, not absolute, since they depend for existence on the perversion or contradiction of their opposites and are not, like truth and good, self-existent absolutes, inherent aspects of the supreme self-existent. So they don't have the authenticity of drawing from the absolute, but exist only by relativity in dialogue with their greater halves. So, truth comes from true existence. Falsehood can be in dialogue with truth, but cannot claim that supreme existence. And the same thing goes for good and evil. So the nether forces of the universe may be large, they may be immense. But what is immensity by comparison with infinity. This is the thing. It is still a mere drop by comparison with what cannot be measured. A second point of questioning emerges from the evidence given for the superphysical and prephysical existence of these dark opposites, for that suggests that they may be, after all, original cosmic principles. So we'll look at this idea too. But it is to be noted that their appearance does not extend higher than the lower superphysical life planes. In other words, the bad things, falsehood, evil, do not appear in the worlds superior to the step or two above us, right? They are, quote, powers of the Prince of Air, end quote. Now, that's a reference to all kinds of things which are biblical and old Persian philosophies, etc. Basically, the Prince of Air is the devil. They are powers of the Prince of Air. Air being in the ancient symbolism, the principle of life, and therefore of the mid-worlds, where the vital principle is predominant and essential. The adverse opposites are not then primal powers of the cosmos, but creations of life or of mind in life. They depend upon these cosmic principles. They do not originate them. The plane of life came into being, and the Rakshasas arose from those realms. They did not create those realms, etc., etc. Their superphysical aspects and influences on Earth nature can be explained by the coexistence of worlds of a descending involution with parallel worlds of an ascending evolution, not precisely created by Earth existence, but created as an annex to the descending world order and a prepared support for the evolutionary terrestrial formations. Here, evil may appear not as inherent in all life, but as a possibility and a preformation that makes inevitable its formation in the evolutionary emergence of consciousness out of the inconscient. So you may remember in the book The Mother, where Sri Aurobindo describes the double ladder of existence. One involutionary, where we reach from these higher worlds through matter, life, and mind down into the inconscient, and eventually from the inconscient, another plane or another scale begins to emerge evolutionarily. First, matter rises from the inconscient, and then life rises from matter, and then mind rises from living matter, etc., etc., tracing more obviously to the external eye what is an upward arc. But always there is that supporting structure behind. This is what he refers to here, the prepared support for the evolutionary terrestrial formations. So evil appears in these lower worlds as a an appearance. Yes. However this may be, it is as an outcome of the inconscience that we can best watch and understand the origin of falsehood, error, wrong, and evil, for it is in the return of inconscience towards consciousness that they can be seen taking their formation, and it is there that they seem to be normal and even inevitable. So it is as we climb out of the inconscience, out of the black swoon that the universe began from, first the material world forms, and then life forms, and it's only as life chugs along and mind begins to appear that we begin to run into error and the experience of evil, the manifestation of evil in the world. So that's what he refers to. The first emergence, he writes, from the inconscient is matter. And in matter, it would seem that falsehood and evil cannot exist because both are created by a divided and ignorant surface consciousness and its reactions. There is no such active surface organization of consciousness. No such reactions in material forces or objects. Whatever indwelling secret consciousness there may be in them seems to be one, undifferentiated, mute, inertly inherent and intrinsic in the energy that constitutes the object. It effectualizes and maintains the form by the silent occult idea in it, but is otherwise self-wrapped in the form of energy it has created, uncommunicated and inexpressive. So in other words, there is an idea which pre-exists, which establishes and justifies the appearance of matter and supports its formation. But that is not intelligible in it directly. It is not good, it is not bad, it is a kind of neutrality. He continues, even if it differentiates itself according to the form of matter in a corresponding form of self-being, rupam rupam pratirupo babhuva. That's from the Katha Upanishad, 2.2.9. There is no psychological organization, no system of conscious actions or reactions. It is only by contact with conscious beings that material objects exercise powers or influences which can be called good or evil. But that good or evil is determined by the contacted being's sense of help or harm, of benefit or injury from them. These values do not belong to the material object, but to some force that uses it, or they are created by the consciousness that contacts it. Fire warms a man or burns him, but that is as involuntarily he meets it or voluntarily uses it. A medicinal herb cures, or a poison kills, but the value of good or evil is brought into action by the user. It is to be observed, too, that a poison can cure as well as kill, a medicine kill or harm as well as cure or benefit. The world of pure matter is neutral, irresponsible. These values insisted on by the human being do not exist in material nature. As a superior nature transcends the duality of good and evil, so this inferior nature falls below it. Huh. So above is the suprarational, and below the infrarational, and what we're talking about is something else. The question may begin to assume a different aspect if we go behind physical knowledge and accept the conclusions of an occult inquiry. For here we are told that there are conscious influences that attach themselves to objects, and these can be good or evil, but it might still be held that this does not affect the neutrality of the object, which does not act by an individualized consciousness, but only as it is utilized for good or for evil, or for both together. The duality of good and evil is not native to the material principle. It is absent from the world of matter. So whatever person imparts a power, whether it is a human or whether it is a being from superphysical planes, the good or the evil that inhabits the physical object does not exist inherently in the physical object. It is lent to it by this superphysical source. And I think that is a well and fitting place to end. I've kept you a long time tonight. We'll meet next on the 29th of January in this year, taking a break of a few weeks while I'll be in Pondicherry in the Sri Aurobindo Ashram for a visit to undertake and continue some projects there. So I look forward to your company again, and I appreciate your patience, and thank you in advance. And as always, extend you my goodwill and best wishes for a new year. You have my love, you have my support. Namaste, Jai Ma, and to all of our friends on Zoom, and some from India, must still be sleepy this morning. Much love to all of you as well. Thank you for coming. So, we'll go for our meditation now. Oh, listen to me. I'm so sorry. I must postpone the moment of meditation because we have a selection from Savitri to read tonight. This is from Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 8, The World of Falsehood. So you can see opposite to our theme in The Life Divine. When nothing was save matter without soul, and a spiritless hollow was the heart of time, then life first touched the insensible abyss. Awaking the stark void to hope and grief, her pallid beam smote the unfathomed night in which God hid himself from his own view. In all things she sought their slumbering mystic truth, the unspoken word that inspires unconscious forms. She groped in his deeps for an invisible law, fumbled in the dim subconscient for his mind, and strove to find a way for spirit to be. But from the night another answer came. A seed was in that nether matrix cast, a dumb, unprobed husk of perverted truth, a cell of an insentient infinite. A monstrous birth prepared its cosmic form in nature's titan embryo, ignorance. Then, in a fatal and stupendous hour, something that sprang from the stark inconscient sleep, unwillingly begotten by the mute void, lifted its ominous head against the stars. Overshadowing Earth with its huge body of doom, it chilled the heavens with the menace of a face. A nameless power, a shadowy will arose, immense and alien to our universe. In the inconceivable purpose none can gauge, a vast non-being robed itself with shape. The boundless nescience of the unconscious depths covered eternity with nothingness. A seeking mind replaced the seeing soul. Life grew into a huge and hungry death. The spirit's bliss was changed to cosmic pain. Assuring God's self-cowled neutrality, a mighty opposition conquered space. A sovereign ruling falsehood, death, and grief, it pressed its fierce hegemony on the earth. Disharmonizing the original style of the architecture of her fate's design, it falsified the primal cosmic will and bound to struggle and dread vicissitudes the long, slow process of the patient power. Implanting error in the stuff of things, it made an ignorance of the all-wise law. It baffled the sure touch of life's hid sense, kept dumb the intuitive guide in matter's sleep, deformed the insect's instinct and the brute's, disfigured man's thought-born humanity. A shadow fell across the simple ray. Obscured was the truth light in the cavern heart that burns unwitnessed in the altar crypt, behind the still velamen's secrecy, companioning the godhead of the shrine. Thus was the dire antagonist energy born, who mimes the eternal mother's mighty shape and mocks her luminous infinity with a gray, distorted silhouette in the night. arresting the passion of the climbing soul. She forced on life a slow and faltering pace. Her hands, deflecting and retarding weight, is laid on the mystic evolution's curve. The tortuous line of her deceiving mind, the gods see not, and man is impotent. Oppressing the god spark within the soul, she forces back to the beast the human fall. Yet, in her formidable instinctive mind, she feels the one grow in the heart of time, and sees the immortal shine through the human mold. We needed to reach that point. Om Namaste Jai Ma.